And at 6, the WBAI Evening News. Up next is Art Breaking with Charlie Finch.
Thank you, Shelton Walden. Good afternoon. Welcome to Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. Today we're going to be talking with John T. Spike, whose terrific book, Fairfield Porter, an American Classic, is just out from Abrams, Inc. Let's hit it off with something from John Mayall. John T. Spike is a noted historian of Italian art of the 16th through 18th century, believe it or not, a graduate of Wesleyan University with MA and PhD from the Fogg Art Museum at Harvard University. He's the author of numerous books and exhibition catalogs, among them Italian still life paintings from three centuries. He lives in Florence with his wife Michelle and young son. Fairfield Porter, John Spike, is a great favorite of my listeners here on Art Breaking, and he really is a painter's painter. And beginning with his biography in the book, Fairfield Porter, an American Classic, you evoke a kind of lost America, the America of pre-World War I, and it can best be described in a quote from Fairfield's mother, Ruth Porter, discussing Fairfield's grandmother. I respected unduly people who took the Atlantic Monthly, had currant jelly with mutton and Yorkshire pudding with roast beef, and I thought gum-chewing not less than indecent. But I'm glad that the Unitarian exaltation of the humanity of Jesus and an abolition tradition added to my father's military experiences in a colored regiment made us free of unhappy prejudices, although our beliefs were not much tested by experience. Tell us a bit about the world that Porter grew up in.
Well, the Porter family was an exceptional family. They represented four long lines of great American families, the Wadsworths, the Longfellows, the Elliots, Porters, coming down all through their line. They were, for example, second cousins of T.S. Eliot. And Eliot visited them and stayed with them when he was once in Chicago on a lecture tour. It was a special time for American families who valued reading and study and self-improvement.
And yet Porter's father was an atheist, and there's kind of an odd atheist tradition in Porter's growing up.
Well, that same tradition of atheism and rational thinking, of course, is known to us from New England. It was always sort of under the skin of and the contrary force to New England Puritanism. It was a rational trend. His father was a scientist, and he represented that to a very individual extent. It's true that at Harvard, when he went, it was rather exceptional to not be a churchgoer.
Fairfield Porter's early life is marked by a number of encounters with famous people, including Alfred North Whitehead, who taught him at Harvard, and Isamu Noguchi, as well as Leon Trotsky. Tell us a few anecdotes about that part of his life.
Well, he had a way of running across important and fascinating people. I think it was because his family was so interesting. He, for instance, went to Russia in 1929. He hadn't been intending to do so. He was in Paris, and he ran into some friends on the street who said they were going. Wouldn't he like to go with them? As he wrote to his family, air travel between Paris and Moscow is pretty rough punishment. It was about a 19-hour flight that departed at 3 a.m., and he said, we counted the progress of the flight not in hours, but in stations as in the crucifixion.
Now, like many artists, in his later life, Fairfield Porter destroyed a lot of his earlier work, being a bit of a perfectionist. And Abrams, of course, has done its usual yeoman-like job with some beautiful reproductions in your book. But let's, for starters, take an early student
work. I think probably Abrams don't want to be compared to yeomen. In my experience of them, they represent a cultural elite.
Let's talk about, though, an early student work, which is quite beautiful and evocative of his future landscapes, Black Sea. Perhaps you can describe it for us.
I'll describe it for you. There's a funny story behind this picture. It's very simple. It looks, the tonalities are blue and cream, like a Marsden Hartley, and it just shows an island that's a simple hump surrounded by waves in front and a slightly swirling sky above. And the funny story is that it was assumed at the Parish Museum at Southampton, where all his works in his collection were donated after his death, that it must be a main scene, and it wasn't for several years that Ann Porter, his widow's correction, was accepted, that this was in fact a student work that he made, the only one he made during his trip to Russia.
In a recent biography of Jackson Pollock, it's mentioned that Pollock sat right next to Porter at the Art Students League in New York, where they studied under Thomas Hart Benton, and that Pollock, who was, of course, temperamentally unsuited to someone of such great taste as Fairfield Porter, envied Porter his drawing skills. Is that true?
You're telling me something I never heard before, and it gives me great pleasure. The different relationships of Pollock and Porter to Benton is a fascinating chapter in American modern painting, because we think of Pollock as the uncontrollable rebel whom nothing could stop as he pushed the adventure of painting, and he certainly did make his contribution. The paradox in Pollock's career is that he began as such a faithful imitator of Benton. As everyone knows, Pollock's early works look like little Bentons. Whereas Porter had very little patience for Benton's approach. He thought he was heavy-handed, and he objected to Benton's theory of art, which, according to Porter, I want to be fair, this is what Porter said, Benton thought that all form could be reduced to, quote, hollows and bumps, which does sound like a Benton, doesn't it?
Certainly does. Let's talk about the influence of two other artists on the young Porter. One is Rockwell Kent. Of course, Porter was involved in the politics of his time living in New York, and the other, of course, the great landscape painter John Marin.
If you were alive in America in the 30s, I'm quoting a commentator on that period, and you were not involved in politics, you were nothing, because it was a time unlike any other time. Our own time, unfortunately, is verging on it, but aside from that political comment, back to the 30s, it seemed to everyone that the status quo had failed miserably, and all thinking people felt charged with a responsibility to come up with some sort of plan for the future. And Porter was a deep thinker, he was a probing thinker, and he was an independent thinker. He had friends in all the different parties. They all vied for his allegiance, and he sometimes felt bad for their sakes, that he wouldn't pledge to the Socialist Party, he wouldn't pledge to the Communist Party. But it was typical of his thinking, and friends of his who are listening will recognize this, that if there were any single item in their platforms, which is only as life is, that he could not accept, then he would not hand over his allegiance. That was his approach.
Wasn't one of the seminal shows that influenced him? By now, he's a man in his early 30s. In 1938, the show of John Marin at Stieglitz's Gallery, an American place.
He has a complicated relationship to Marin, is how I say him, because being a semi-native of Maine, he naturally was aware of Marin even earlier. And he was, of course, very impressed by Stieglitz and what Stieglitz was doing. He thought Stieglitz was the only art dealer in America who defended and supported his artists and wasn't in it only as a commercial affair. So throughout the 30s, you find Porter landscapes. There aren't a lot of them because, as you said, Charlie, he destroyed them ruthlessly. You often find Marin influences creeping into his existing landscapes from the 30s. More important was a Vuillard-Bonnard show he saw at the end of that decade.
Yes. Let's talk about the influence of Viard and Bernard. As you rightly point out in the book, it's forgotten that those two artists lived until the 1940s, and their late work was an influence on Porter, yes?
Right. This is a way of looking at our history with clear eyes that I find strikes people especially. That is, when we think about art and when we look through a book, when we're told something about it, it's always put down when these artists make their debut, as though they're ballerinas, let's say. And so Vuillard and Bonnard are nabis, and as far as the art texts are concerned, they dropped dead after the 1890s were over, whereas it isn't true at all. And we now see, in fact, that late Bonnard is fabulous. And what Porter did was to look to some of the best contemporary figurative painting in the world, that is, in France, from Vuillard and Bonnard, who were both still alive in 1940.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. We're talking with John T. Spike, author of Fairfield Porter, an American classic just out from Abrams, Inc. Let's take a musical break. Something from the Blues Project. Welcome back to Art Breaking. Just to note, I've been spending some time at the PDG Gallery lately at 510 East 11th Street between Avenues B and C. They have a really nice kind of salon environment there, and they're currently showing work by John Carnwright. They're also having a poetry and painting evening Wednesday, October 28th from 6 to 10 p.m. For information, call PDG at 777-1814. I should also say there's a show concurrent with John Spike's book of Fairfield Porter's work at Herschel and Adler, 21 East 70th Street, running through October. Now, John Spike, Fairfield Porter's life is almost a textbook example of what artists think an artist's life should be like. Years of obscurity, money problems, kind of a middle-aged breakthrough, continuing problems with art dealers and critics, etc. Then fame and worldwide renown, followed by a premature death.
I think at the end, it's you make it sound rosier than it was. But he did enjoy recognition from other painters. He had a few moments in the national press, but curiously, when it was realized that he just was not going to fit into pop art or some other ism, then the attention strayed, because the press naturally prefers things that come pre-labeled. And Porter is a fascinating example of a major artist whom everyone appreciates, but he's not in the textbooks because there's no chapter for him. The way art theory was written up in the post-war period, they didn't leave space for him. There was a theory, there is one way to paint, and it is as Clem Greenberg says while sparring with Harold Rosenberg. And they sketched out between them a single line of development, and a lot of good painters were involved in their understanding and were championed by them. I'm not saying that they championed artists who weren't wonderful, Klein and Rothko and Pollock. These are important artists. But we now have the vantage point to realize that this period of time is no different from any other period of time, and there never was a time when there was only one way to paint and think about art.
Of course, one person who was free of these prejudices was the great painter William de Kooning, whose wife Elaine was close friends with Fairfield and Ann Porter, and indeed, wasn't Bill de Kooning instrumental in getting Fairfield Porter hooked up with the Tibor Denage Gallery?
Very, very much so. And Fairfield was given a very helpful boost also by the young Larry Rivers and Jane Freilicher. The story about Bill de Kooning's intervention was told in his memoirs by John Bernard Myers, who was artistic director at the Tibor Denage Gallery, and it's very amusing because de Kooning showed up one day at the gallery and he said, "I've got an important artist for you." He hasn't had recognition because Porter was older. He was already 40 years old. And I really think you should show him because he's good. And de Kooning was always respected for his frank way of speaking. And John Meyer said, Bill, with a testimony like this, just have him bring his works by. And Fairfield showed up, not with, it would be anachronistic to say, with the women, but not with abstract pictures, but with these intimate Bonar-style domestic interiors, people seated and his family on couches. And John Myers felt at first he had been painted into a corner.
Didn't Myers, first of all, think the work was a tad awkward, particularly with the blending of figures and space?
It's even fair to say that in 1951, 1952, Porter was still developing. He was coming out of things he had been taught at Harvard and at the Art Students League, as we were saying about Benton before the break. At Harvard, he was taught, quote, too much painting after nature cripples your imagination. And you can tell, Charlie, this wasn't good for Porter, because Porter's whole art is based on precise observation of nature.
John Myers described Porter as perhaps the most honest person that he ever met, and this honesty was part of Porter's role as an art critic as well, writing first for Art News and then The Nation. Was this honesty to a fault a detriment to Porter's career?
That is a tough question, because you're asking me really to make a guess. His frankness often rubbed people the wrong way, and he had a reputation because one of his major concerns was also conservation. He had a reputation among many people as a kind of crank because he was so blunt. You mentioned how he destroyed paintings he didn't like. The poet Kenneth Koch told me that once he visited his friend Porter in his studio, and Porter was putting the last touches on a big canvas, and Koch said, "That's a good one." And Porter said, without looking up, "I'm going to burn it."
One of the fascinating things that you point out, John Spike, is that even with a relatively prestigious gallery like Tibor Denage, Porter was responsible for a number of the jobs that you would now expect a gallery to perform for an artist, correct?
One of the things I documented in the book was actually gallery practice and how it evolved. As you know, I mainly study Italian Old Master painters, and what we're trained to do is to garner every piece of evidence we can. You can imagine what a field day I had with Porter. I wrote off to Harvard, where he went and got his transcripts, I got his college application, I read his juvenile essays, and we have more than 400 letters by him, and we have his business papers. And we have his complaints that he was responsible for trucking around his own paintings as the dealer, his dealers thought they had a chance to sell them, and so forth. And he had to pay for his own flyers. That's the way it was in the 50s.
Porter's devoted wife, Anne, an extraordinarily looking person, and his children, of course, served as private subjects for much of his greatest work. Indeed, the family joked that the large painting of his family on the porch was four ugly people.
That's right, that's what they always called it.
And a fascinating insight you have in your book, John, concerns the fact that Porter is really always painting for himself, as his own private audience.
It's the key to his art, and it emerges from his own statements. He gave a long interview in 1968 that was very valuable. He painted things that he knew well, that meant a lot to him, and he didn't try to indicate through symbol or touch, only his choice of view, the importance of these scenes for him himself. He is the principal audience of his own pictures. And this, of course, was quite out of step with art of the 60s, which was art made, pop art, soup cans, billboards, for a mass global non-individual eye.
Aren't there indications that Porter valued his studies of people a lot more than his landscape art and had kind of an ambivalent relationship with his landscape art, saying things like, "I wonder why I do it," and having moments of frustration with it?
Well, all painters have moments of frustration, as you know, Charlie, because all painters, and Porter did this constantly, ask themselves, why do this? Who cares? That is the private nightmare of all artists, because they work alone and they receive such sparse responses. He thought, when painting landscapes, often, this is so beautiful, perhaps my pictures are not living up to it.
John Spike, every artist who now paints out on the east end of Long Island, male or female, is in a sense a son and daughter of Fairfield.
Many of them consider themselves such.
Rightly or wrongly. First of all, how did Fairfield Porter end up in Southampton after living in New York and before that in Winnetka, Illinois? And what were really the beginnings of that whole scene?
Well, it happened by accident. Pollock had already moved out there. They weren't friends, as you know. They weren't enemies. In fact, I heard the funny story from Ann Porter that once Fairfield was in Pollock's studio, and he said, "I like this new work." And Pollock said to him fiercely, "Those are my wife's, Lee Krasner's."
A very honest mistake, as Lee Krasner painted Pollock's, and may have even argued that Pollock painted Lee Krasner's.
And so he wasn't drawn out to the Hamptons by Pollock's magnet. He was looking for space. He was looking to be close to nature. And it was rural there, and there was the sea. And recently, Ann Porter told me that he also had the thought that maybe if they could rent their house during the summers, it would help pay for them to go up to Maine while they were away, and Southampton being a resort, that was another motive.
One of the most famous images, pictures, that Porter painted, of course, was his portrait of Elaine de Kooning, painted in 1957. You also, in researching this painting, found out something about the influence of Sargent on the painting.
I have been thinking, and I'm constantly thinking, about Porter's development, and I realized only recently that I had overlooked the importance of Sargent for him. He wrote an important essay about Sargent, and he said, "Though people don't realize it, American abstract painters owe as much to Sargent's way of putting down paint, which was very bold, as we all know, and pure color fields and so forth, as they do to the European moderns." And while reviewing his works in chronological order, I realized that there's a major step up in the key of Porter's colors in the year after he saw and wrote about that Sargent show. And this Elaine de Kooning portrait, which is at the Met, shows her dressed in a raincoat and a dress, and they seem, in a Sargent way, like pure, beautiful, flowing fields of orange and ochre.
In painting the members of his family, there's often kind of a vacant, even sad, feeling about the eyes and faces of the family members. Is this something that was genetically inherited from Fairfield Porter's own mother?
People often ask about the expression, and sometimes almost lack of expression, in the faces of the people that Porter portrayed. His mother did wear an expression, like that. We know from a photograph of her. I think that the main reason for the quiet, subdued expression in his portraits is that he's actually portraying the face that a person wears when they're quietly posing over a matter of some hours.
So that would make him a super realist, in a sense.
You take my breath away.
Vis-a-vis the human face.
You take my breath away because Porter, as a critic, I think argued eloquently against an over-reliance on terminology. And I don't know what you mean
by
that
term. Sorry to offend you, Fairfield. Let's take another musical break and hear something from Mark Johnson on his new release from Tabula Rasa. Welcome back to Art Breaking. Mark Johnson will be my guest here for a live concert next Thursday in our usual slot, 3 to 4 p.m. on October 22. You can get his disc from Tabula Rasa Records at fine record stores everywhere. That's next Thursday, 3 to 4, if you want to hear more of Mark Johnson live. Again, I'm talking with John T. Spike, author of Fairfield Porter, an American classic just out from Abrams, Inc. And I should say it's a great pleasure to have Michelle Spike and Jennifer Broden here in the studio with us as well. To give you a sense of Porter's not so prickly, but really prickly personality, let me read from a letter that John Spike quotes in his book concerning Porter and the collector Ben Heller. He's writing, I believe, Tibor Nagy and John Myers.
That's right, his dealers.
When I agreed to sell the new painting to you for $1,500, I understood that you would buy it immediately. I did not mean to reserve the pear tree for you until you had been able to sell it. Now Ben Heller does not like the new painting. Does this mean that you cannot pay me for it? If so, our deal is off. I did not agree to reserve it for you at $1,500. I would ask $3,600 at Guildhall for it, which would mean that I would get $2,400. Since you haven't yet sent me the $1,500, I suppose it is because there is some difficulty from Ben Heller. Some time ago, when I was in financial difficulties, I sold it a Koenig to him for $7,000. I had asked $8,000. He made me the smaller offer because, I later found out, Eugene Thaw had offered him $8,000. In other words, Ben Heller was not, as I thought, buying the de Koenig for himself, but in order to make a quick $1,000. What he did was use my distress as an opportunity to make money. And now, from what you tell me, he seems to be a man who is in the habit of engaging in shark practices. Therefore, I want to let you know right off that I will never agree to give Ben Heller any discounts. If I have a special price for him, it will be a specially high one. I am not impressed by any of the arguments that run like this. Ben Heller is an important collector. I do not want to be in good with him. See, so if your purchase depends on Ben Heller, please let me know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, John, of course, the artists and audience will love this, hearing Porter telling off
so there's a lot of material in the
well-known
book.
Collectors, et cetera. In general, what was his relationship with collectors like, though? The Rockefellers collected his work, for example.
He didn't have many collectors and didn't know them personally. Especially, he relied on, and he felt always he was well served by his dealers, Tibor Denage, and the gallery is directed by John Bernard Myers. But what he was saying in that letter was he didn't want to hear any more of the usual gallery guff, which explains how you have to make special concessions to the few people who are ever going to buy the picture anyway, because these things never do develop onto other opportunities. And if you give a special price break to someone, they later won't want one. For example, Joe Hirshhorn was one of the most notorious bargainers in the history of contemporary collecting, and dealers turned colors as he approached because they thought maybe a sale was on its way, but certainly some ferocious haggling. Now, let me finish a point here, Charlie.
Certainly.
And this is typical of Porter. He could not bear temperamentally the thought that his paintings were something that would be speculated on. And he arranged his estate so to minimize speculation on his paintings.
You know, there's still some critical resistance to Fairfield Porter. In fact, even though he had very hip friends to whom he was a mentor, like Frank O'Hara, John Ashbery, and Larry Rivers, the only critic that has really championed him consistently is Hilton Kramer, wouldn't you say?
Well, there's no doubt about that. Kramer is the only critic who has said from the start, Porter is important. Porter has always received lip service, and there was a piece last week which was more lip service. Maybe people don't want to pick a fight.
From Michael Kimmelman, you mean?
That's the piece. I mean, he realizes he doesn't want to fight this one out, but it's obvious his heart isn't in it. The problem with Porter's reputation is that people buy the same old line that there was only one way to paint in the 50s and 60s, and they're not prepared to open their minds and throw over the old Greenbergian system. But it's going to have to happen, and my book is a salvo in that battle.
I think the critics like Clem Greenberg and Michael Kimmelman, who really aren't trained in the arts and come to it later in life, have kind of a deep insecurity that they constantly have to be hip and wonder if they're really saying the right thing. And it was marvelous watching in the review in which Kimmelman discusses your book and the show at Herschel and Adler, how he grudgingly conceded that Fairfield Porter is a great artist and forced himself to discuss the details of his work.
It was all just cribbed from my book, about which he complained there wasn't enough analysis. If he'd read a little deeper, he could have learned more and put in a few more nice observations.
How did Fairfield Porter meet Larry Rivers, John Spike?
They met because Porter was reviewing for Art News, and he saw absolutely everything going on in New York City. He gave up 2 weeks of every month during the 50s to see all the galleries and what was going on.
He has my retroactive sympathies, because I do the same thing.
Yeah, it can grind you down.
But there is an extraordinary influence in Larry Rivers, particularly his portrait work, to Fairfield Porter, don't you think?
There wasn't that much exchange between them. Maybe they were so close as friends that they were aware of the possibility and they avoided it. Rivers, for one thing, before he became so super realistic in painting Bertie, comes out of Matisse, and Porter not. It's interesting that Porter was not interested in Matisse. He was interested in Vuillard and Bonnard.
There's a terrific reproduction in your book of probably the most wild portrait of Andy Warhol I've ever seen. When Warhol
he
was
looks
a
so
famous
sedate.
Commercial artist, of Ted Carey and Andy Warhol. This was a commission piece?
Yes, it was a commission piece, and he was very excited about every portrait commission he got. He was so happy to get that $1,500. One of his last commissions was to paint the president of the Harvard Club here in New York, and he treated it with the same seriousness as though it were John Cage.
Now, Porter did, in his lifetime, have kind of a window of hipness in the early 60s, just before pop art broke and after abstract expressionism had a bit of a lull, when Philip Perlstein broke through and other figurative artists. What was Porter just shocked that had even happened, and why was it so short-lived, that 2 years, like in 61 and 62, when figurative art did a comeback?
Well, it's a perfect example of how our art world is so trendy. By the early 60s, people had seen every possibility of abstract painting, and they had woken up to the fact that figurative painting was going on. Porter complained it had never stopped, the way the newspapers claimed. And he was featured in Newsweek magazine along with Wayne Thiebaud, a very, very different painter. And this is the difference between Porter and all the other painters of that time. Thiebaud painted archetypes. He painted sort of perfect cakes, not a cake on his counter. And Porter painted his own life.
What's fascinating about Fairfield Porter is how the dictates of light as he's painting, and this is why I keep talking about realism, change from picture to picture. And let's talk about two terrific landscape paintings featured in your book that are right next to each other as an example of this, Wheat and Children in a Field.
Yeah, I love this picture, Wheat. It's square. It's out on Southampton. And basically, it's three rectangles, or two rectangles, like a Rothko, and on the horizon line where they meet, there's a Southampton colonial-style house and some trees, and, of course, the sky is a rectangle of blue, and down below is one of those Southampton brown fields. This is of wheat. It's both sensuous from the point of view of these two delicious fields of color and very, very particular. You know even the time of day, and it's obviously a winter, an autumn, I should say, day in a specific place. His pictures differ and are as individual as the moments and places in his life. When I was asked to put in 150 photographs in this book, and as I started putting them together, I ended up with 280. And I sent them all in to Abrams, who published them all. The reason being was that Porter did not repeat himself. He didn't have a motif that he did on and on.
Let's take another musical break, another cut from John Mayall, and we'll be back to talk with John Spike some more. Welcome back to Art Breaking. John Spike is that rare art critic and writer, having been educated at the Fabb Museum at Harvard and at Wesleyan, you would think that he was so erudite. which he is, but he writes so perfectly, crystal clear, and you'll love this book from Abrams, Fairfield Porter, an American classic, because it is written so well and the reproductions are so gorgeous. Porter, like many great artists, had extreme periods of self-doubt. His diaries and letters reveal that he's always challenging himself and wondering, is his work any good? And as he goes on in life into his 50s and 60s, he starts painting a few more self-portraits. Was this kind of a way of dealing with the psychological problems of being a painter?
That is a good question, although, again, you're asking me to guess about him. And I'll give you a guess, but I want to say part of my approach in writing the book was to compile Porter's writings about himself and documents about his life, his own writings, and keep to a minimum and label as such my guesses about him. I think that he painted more and more self-portraits, just as you've noticed, because he began to think about the very modern question, what is painting in relation to life, and what do these pictures mean to the people who see them? And as we've said, he was always the principal audience of his own pictures. This naturally gave him the idea, I think, it's a guess, to paint his own features. He was very taken by Las Meninas, a great self-portrait.
Well, Velázquez.
And he made numerous compositions that are disguised, not very disguised, homages to Las Meninas.
Do you think Porter was accident-prone? You have a great description of when he runs into the train out in Southampton. Tell us about that.
Charlie, you're a great man because it's clear you've read this book carefully. And I never said it, but it strikes me as incredible that he had three near-fatal car crashes. And the last one, which was, I guess you'd have to call it his personal record, he described it in a letter that I quote. He said, it didn't seem severe at court at first. I got up. I started walking to some people who were running towards me, waving their arms. And then I realized that I had gotten out of the car, which had been flipped onto its top, and the train that had passed, he was crossing tracks, had sheared off the back half of the car.
And yet he got up and walked away from it, thus shocking the medics, et cetera.
Yeah, bleeding, and some lady who they stopped the car to give him a lift to the Southampton hospital fainted instead.
I recently posed for a portrait that Phyllis Herfield asked me to do. And, of course, whenever you pose for an artist, you have a sense of losing complete control, which is something that a radio interviewer doesn't like to do. And I wondered in portraits, incredible portraits of his wife Anne, what her feelings were about them. They get into her soul extraordinarily. Indeed, his love for her kind of sets her apart as a subject from either even other members of his family. Do you think that's true?
The portraits of Anne are very special because Anne Porter is an extraordinarily intelligent person, educated as Fairfield was, and a sensitive poet in her own right. And, of course, Fairfield's portraits of her reflect her intellect. What she was thinking, she never ventured to tell me, so I can't say.
Describe the Porter's relationship with poets such as Kenneth Koch and John Ashbery and others.
He met the New York School poets and made good friends with them, Ashbery and Koch and Frank O'Hara and Jimmy Schuyler, who, as Anne Porter said to me, came for a visit and stayed 11 years. James Schuyler died earlier this year, in fact. he made fast friends with them because they shared his love of literature, and he loved their spontaneity, the way they would pull from their coats poems they had read and would share. And they made him feel also more alive in the importance that they gave to thinking and talking.
Some work that I was not familiar with of Fairfield Porter's that's reproduced in the book are these extraordinary ocean paintings from late in his life.
Those are many people's favorites, Charlie.
I wondered if you might discuss them for us a bit.
Well, we have a double-page spread of three, and if you don't know his scenes of the surf, it's always the surf in Southampton, by the way, never Maine. You will be struck by them. And if you know these, then you'll be very pleased by this spread, because, as it points out, he had no technique, convention, manner for treating water, treating sky, or sand. He painted these portraits of this time and day, the way the angle of the light is reflected off the waves, the way they break, that a meteorologist could tell you which way the wind was blowing. And they're infinitely more satisfying for being so immediate. And if you know Porter's work, you have to always remember that these are freely painted. I mean, he's not a 19th century painter. I mean, they, in terms of touch, they come closest to Bonnard.
Porter also had a dislike of pets, and yet one of the great figures in his life was his dog Bruno, whom he also painted. Do you find that Bruno has a kind of bemused expression in Porter's depictions of him?
That, I'm sure, is an unfair question, because if I dignify it with a response, Charlie, I don't know where I'll end up. But sticking to the facts, he loved this dog that his daughter Lizzie had wanted, and then, as happens all the time, Lizzie, his youngest child, grew up and went off to college and left the dog with her parents. And the dog sat there patiently and ended up being the sole figure in many of the late pictures.
Did Porter get satisfaction later in life from teaching? He was always a great friend to younger artists, and he taught a year at Amherst, for example, and was asked to teach at many other places.
He took extraordinary satisfaction from teaching. He loved encouraging painters. He had a year as an artist in residence at Amherst in 1968-69, which he took just because the meager salary was of great use to him. And everything he painted that year was so fine. The somewhat sad thing is he would have given anything had they asked him to stay on. But of course, this kind of appointment is only ever 1 year, and that was it.
They're so stupid at Amherst because, of course, he arrives at Amherst and he gets this great perspective of the parking lot and immediately produces two or three fantastic masterpieces. I mean, are they idiots at Amherst?
Well, it's not fair to say, Charlie, because he made lots of friends while he was there, but they didn't ever think of asking him to stay on. And it's a shame because they'd have some museum now with pictures. You mentioned the parking lot. He has these pictures out the window and they show this New England foliage, but then the foreground has these three cars, and he somehow makes you pleased by the colors of these cars without pretending, because it would be a stupid idea, without pretending that a car is as pretty as autumn foliage.
What is the status of Fairfield Porter in museum collections now? And one thing is curious. You mentioned Lloyd Goodrich, the legendary curator at the Whitney, a bit in passing in the book, who was, of course, the man who made Edward Hopper's career. Was Goodrich a fan of Porter's, do you know?
I don't know that about him, but the Whitney deserves credit for having, by far, having brought together the best group of Porters of any place other than the Parish Art Museum in Southampton, which received his estate. The representation of Porters in American museums is embarrassingly sparse, and the lack of interest by American museum curators in Porter is a national embarrassment.
We'll have to correct that, John Spike. And your book, Fairfield Porter, an American classic, just out from Abrams, will certainly go a long way in doing that.
I wrote it as such, Charlie. Now we'll see.
I'd like to thank you for being my guest on Art Breaking today. Also, remember there's a concurrent show with the book at Herschel and Adler, 21 East 70th, up through October. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you on the radio next week when my guest will be Mark Johnson doing a live concert, 3 p.m. October 22. Have a good afternoon, and thank you, Shelton Walden.